moratorium, which is stronger than any other moratorium in our region, in the state, that it was because of community pressure that these things happened. And that is unfortunate. And the situations we're living in right now, it really is life or death for so many people and marginalized people.
Carol,
we have to do better.
I want to thank you so much for being with us. Alliance of Californians for Community Empowerment, speaking to us from her home to keep the community safe and stop community spread. And Martha Escondero, mother of two and Reclaiming Our Homes member, speaking from the first Reclaiming Our Homes house, speaking to us again from home to protect the whole community. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Tammy Waramnoff, Libby Rainey, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Rabbi Karen, Honey Masood, Sharina Nadura, Tamari Astudio, Adriano Contreras, Maria Terracena, Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman.
Listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM and KBOO.FM online.
This is From the Vault, the Pacifica Radio Archives weekly series where we get to profile some of the amazing recordings in our 55,000 program collection going back to 1949. I'm your host, Mark Torres. On this edition of From the Vault, we celebrate the life of Dick Gregory, comedian, civil rights activist, and humanitarian, who died on Saturday, August 19th, 2017, at the age of 84. The challenge of creating humor out of something as bleak and tragic as racism in America fell into the hands of a young man from Chicago with an acerbic wit and a charismatic presence. In the 1950s and early 1960s, Dick Gregory became one of the first African-American comedians to successfully deal with race to both white and black audiences, and he confronted race and class head-on. Today we celebrate Dick Gregory, who is easily among the great political comedians such as Lenny Bruce, Mort Saul, George Carlin, Richard Pryor, Bill Cosby, and Chris Rock, just to name a few.
And I really thought the answer was, if I could just get into them white schools, I'd be all right, because I thought white folks had the truth. Yeah, I'd get over there and pick up that white book and it says, Columbus discovered America. Damn, you know that punk got lost. How you discover a country that's already occupied? Where was the Indians when that boy got here? And that's serious business, baby. If you can discover a country that's already occupied, I can go out on the parking lot right now and discover your car with you in it.
Dick Gregory became a regular guest on Pacifica Radio beginning in the early 1960s and at one time a Pacifica National Board member. Here's California State Los Angeles history professor Lamont Yeakey to say a few words about Dick Gregory.
I first became aware of him when I was a young student growing up in Chicago, and he lived in Chicago. I remember people who would encounter him first as a stand-up comedian in various clubs. We think of him as a great humorist and a great comedian, but he's infinitely more than that.
Dick Gregory's social and political consciousness was impacted by the events that sparked the early civil rights movement, the murder of 14-year-old Emmett Till in Mississippi, and the Montgomery bus boycott in Alabama, which catapulted Rosa Parks and Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. to national attention. In the late 1950s, Gregory began regular visits to the South to participate in the civil rights demonstrations. Gregory was arrested for civil disturbance during one such visit to Birmingham, Alabama. A few weeks later, on May 25, 1963, Dick Gregory sat down with Pacifica Radio KPFA producer Ralph Gleason in an extraordinary conversation, revealing the trials and tribulations of this popular entertainer traveling to the South to help his people in the thick of the civil rights movement. Keep in mind, Dick Gregory was a highly paid entertainer at the time and used his own money to fly in food and supplies as well as himself as needed.
Dick, why did you go to Birmingham?
Well, I guess it was the same reason I went to Greenwood, Mississippi.
Okay, why'd you go to Mississippi at all in the first place?
Well, as I read the account of actually what was going on in these areas in the South, and think of the three kids that I have, and knowing that the people that's breaking down the barriers down South, and not only breaking them down for themselves, but breaking them down for myself, my wife, and my family, and I feel that it's part of my job to help them break it down, being that all of us will reap the benefits from this. I debated the night before I flew into Greenwood, Mississippi, simply because I had a new son, and I hadn't been able to get back to Chicago to see the boy. And Mississippi won out, because when I lay there and thought that if America had to go to war in the morning, I would be willing to go. And when I can go to any of the four corners of the world, take a chance on losing my life, being away from my loved ones, to guarantee a foreigner a better way of life, I must be able to go and guarantee the Negro a better way of life.
Was there any pressure upon you at all as a performer not to do this?
No, no one. No one knew I was gone but a couple of close friends of mine. My managers found out after I got there, which they wouldn't have said anything anyway, because we have a relationship where they know they work for me.
Yeah.
And my agent works for me, and my managers work for me, and everyone on my staff, including my lawyers on down, works for me. So I make the decisions and the policies of Dick Gregory Enterprise.
Do you see this move as a role for you as a performer, as an artist, or as you as a human being?
No, me as a human being. I've said many times I'm an individualist first, an American second, and a Negro third, but I'm a Negro before I'm an entertainer.
Mm-hmm.
So when my decision to go into any area or to participate in any affair, I do this as an individualist. But I try to stay away from where there's nothing but entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, these restrictions where you can't come into the area 60 days before and after, I never honor these at all.
But inevitably, your public personality as a performer gets involved in this, doesn't it?
Not with me.
Not with you?
No, none whatsoever.
Does it get involved with the people that you work for at clubs or with the audiences?
No, I have never found it. Maybe mainly because I don't look for it.
Mm-hmm.
But I have never found it to be so.
When you got to Mississippi, were they aware of you as a performer? Were you just another individual?
No, what happened was with Mississippi, the move that was made that meant so much in Mississippi, I could have gone in any area of the South and with less impact, because in many areas of the South, Dick Gregory was unheard of,
mm-hmm.
was unknown, because you take the Delta area, these people, the average Negro take home pay is $300 a year. He's not reading the type of books that I've been getting the write-ups in for the last 2 years,
yeah.
The television, not 90% of them do not have them. So, but when I flew in the plane load of surplus food into the Delta area, this is what made Dick Gregory in this area. The police knew this. This is why I never got arrested in Greenwood, Mississippi, because of a lot of the Negroes thought I was a preacher. Many never knew I was an entertainer.
The cops all knew, though.
Oh, yes, the cops knew.
Yeah.
And when I decided to go into Greenwood, Mississippi, I never realized the impact it would have on the American press. I never knew of the amount of FBI agents that would be coming down, because I called a fellow by the name of Aaron Henry in Clarksdale, Mississippi. When I had airlifted the food in, I didn't have too much time because I had to go right back to the Playboy Club in Chicago. But I told Aaron Henry the first time I had a couple of days off, I would be back. And I had a Monday and a Tuesday off. I was going down to speak Monday night in Greenwood, Tuesday in Clarksdale.
Professor Lamont Yakey.
And it was really Hugh Hefner's Playboy Clubs series that began to give him a kind of a visibility beyond just the confines of the black neighborhood clubs. But he began to do something even more significant, I think, by the early 60s. I mean, his work was not just to get a simple laugh for the moment, but he educated us, he taught us, he compelled us to be compassionate and sensitive to one another and to ourselves. And I think this is among his many gifts, and certainly a part of his great contribution to our life of culture, not just Black culture, but American culture, and even perhaps world culture.
And now back to Dick Gregory, interviewed in studio by Ralph Gleason on May 25th, 1963.
I never knew of the amount of FBI agents that would be coming down, because I called a fellow by the name of Aaron Henry in Clarksdale, Mississippi. When I had airlifted the food in, I didn't have too much time because I had to go right back to the Playboy Club in Chicago. But I told Aaron Henry the first time I had a couple of days off, I would be back. And I had a Monday and a Tuesday off. I was going down to speak Monday night in Greenwood, Tuesday in Clarksdale. And only after I got in this area and really got to see firsthand what was going on, because when I brought the food in, I really didn't get to see. We unloaded it, I got in a car, and I went right back to Memphis and jetted out. Oh, not until I got there to speak that night and watched and listened and was briefed on a couple of things. For instance, in Greenwood, Mississippi, where the population is 22,000 white, 24,000 Negro. There's one hospital in the whole town with 168 beds, and 138 beds are for white. Well, a Negro can't even afford to get sick there. There, with a population of 24,000 Negroes, there's not one Negro doctor. So when these people decide to march down to this court building and sign their names and identify themselves, they're also saying that I'm giving up all my medical care because these doctors will not see them anymore. Not mainly because the doctors might not want to, but because of the pressure that would be put on. So when a person says, I'll do this for freedom, and this opens your eyes.
Again, Lamont Yakey.
Well, Dick Gregory wasn't just a man of words or just humor. He was a man of action. And what stands out to my mind again and again among all the wonderful things he's done with his life and for us is that he had immense courage and a man of strong conviction. And he was not adverse to traveling south. He's not adverse to being at the forefront, not at the tail end or speaking to these issues from afar, but dealing with them firsthand.
How many of them vote in the 24,000?
We never could find out, because you go in and you register to vote. And it's about a month before they let you know how many have actually passed the test. From looking at the test, if they decided no one would pass the test, no one would pass the test. Because out of the five pages, there's only actually two questions. One is to fill in blank spot. They put the article, fill in blank such and such article, the Mississippi Constitution. Write it in. Okay, now if you memorize this, the second question is the one that throws you. They say, now, in the space below, explain what your interpretation of this means. Yeah. So if you have the exact interpretation of it, when the clerk grades the paper, this is not right.
Yeah.
So this is the problem that they have. So it mainly ended up being a demonstration of, for the first time in 100 years, being able to walk down to the court building and in a group, in a large group. I know I made the comment the day the police was real worried. We had about 50 persons down to register, and they were, you know, like everybody was upset. They followed us, didn't want us to walk in large lines. So I asked the police commissioner, I said, wouldn't it be wild if you found out all they was really trying to do is pay their water tax?
When you said things like that to people like him, what was their reaction?
Oh, well, this Hammond, this is probably one of the most beautiful individuals I ever met in my life. He, on the outside, he's for the people there, but on the inside, he has enough sense to know what's going on. And anyone that would call the Greenwood jail for me, which I wasn't there, a lot of people felt I was arrested there, would call the Greenwood jail. He was in a compound to bring me the message. And this boiled down to the second day in town was to see who could outwit who. And this is what it boiled down to then.
How did that work?
Well, one day they would win, the next day we would win. Actually, what happened, they stopped our lines. The police chief, if you can imagine a guy being so stupid, he had to read from a piece of paper. He would hold it up. He said, we will permit you to go to the court building to register in small groups. We are not going to permit large crowds to go to the court building register. So I am asking you to break up this large group to to go to Court Building Ranch or turn your lines back. So the first day we decided to turn back. And we caught them by surprise because they stopped us about two blocks from our headquarters. And we all turned back, jumped in cars, and drove everyone over to the court building. Yeah. Now, this was the first picture was released where the cop had my arm.
Yeah.
So coming back that afternoon, we decided we'd walk. So we walk out of the court building, we make a left turn, and this is when it happened. So we put them in cars and carried them back over that afternoon. And leaving, the Negro district is located. You come out of the court building, you make a left. So they had all the police set up this way. So it was just a simple matter, walking in the front of the line and said, look, we'll wait till everyone comes out and we'll go right. And this caught them completely by surprise. And by the time they had gathered up the string of police that sat down for about 20 blocks and called them all back there, we had marched about 9 blocks. And nothing had happened. And the press was there, so they to come up and stop us then, after we'd walked so long with no problems, it would just been unheard of. So eventually they did stop us. And they put two of the SNCC leaders in jail, put them in the cars and hauled them off. So everyone was wondering, what do we do now? So I said, we'll stand on the corner until they bring them back or put us all in jail. So rather than do this, they grabbed me, they put me in the police car, and they grabbed another girl and they put her in the police car. But instead of taking us to jail, they carried us to the SNCC headquarters. So when the cops stopped the car, I gave him $2. I said, thank you, cabbie. We jumped in the car. We went right back to that corner, and I told the police commissioner, I said, look, baby, I said, if you say I'm under arrest, put me in jail. I said, but if you take me anywhere other than jail, that's kidnapping, you know. And it was just a running thing. And then after I found out the next day, they arrested everyone but me. And I said, say, Hammond, look, you have my writer, and I want to find out the bail. What's the bond going to be? And he said, well, I won't know. I said, I'll tell you what. If you find out real quick for me what's the bail going to be for all of us, I will walk from here to the police department station, and I'll ask you in front of all your friends. I'll call you Mr., something I haven't called you since I've been here. And he loved this. He said, really? And this is when the papers read, well, I was left standing alone and walked by myself to the police station. So by the time I got to the police station, he was holding a press conference so they could hear this. So I walked up. I put my finger in his face. I said, Mr. Hammond, you told a damn lie on me yesterday.
Professor Lamont Yakey.
Gregory brought a black sensibility into the mix and compelled even whites to understand themselves better with regard to their confrontation or their friendship, whatever the case may be, with black people.
And it was just a running thing like this. And this is when I called my wife to come down. And I called and I was very honest with her. I said, I want to ask you something, and there's no love involved. It's not husband and wife relationship that I'm asking you this. I said, I'm up against it, and this had turned out to be a game of wits. They will not arrest me, but it would be very embarrassing if they arrested Mrs. Gregory, who's been out of the hospital 2 days with her third child. Would you get on a plane and fly in? No one will know but myself, you, and use your maiden name. So she flew in. I sent two guys up to Memphis to meet and bring in. And she marched every day for 3 days, and no one knew she was there. And I had already told her, I said, if they arrest you, give me your maiden name. And I checked with an attorney, and I said, look, what kind of rap can they grab us on by her not giving her? And he said, well, this is legal. She can give a maiden name. And but at this point, they had laid off. But this would have been a shocker, you know. But this is what it boiled down to. Mm-hmm. We found out that they was finding out a lot of our moves from the Negro maids. And you have to understand, these Negroes in this area love these white people that they work for, and the white people actually love them. See, the difference in the North and the South is in the South, they respect a Negro as an individualist. They love him as an individualist. This one, the sheriff better not hit this one. He's in trouble. Whereas up North, the Negro is respected as a group. They say, well, I won't hire one of them, but if you get your FEPC pushed through, then I'll hire them all. Say, well, we don't want one, but if you can get that fair housing bill through, we'll let them all come in, which isn't true. But this is the difference in the attitude in the North and the South. And when I found out that a lot of our moves was being tipped off through the maids, then every night after the church meeting, I would ask, how many of you here works for the white ladies in the daytime? And they'd raise their hand. We'd take them in the back room. I said, well, now, let me tell you. I said, at about 1 o'clock tomorrow, or maybe 3, and then we'd put times on a piece of paper and say, you tell the people you're working for that this is going to happen, that this is going to happen. By the time they finish checking out the good tips against the bad ones, they eventually gave it up. So then it got down to a point where everyone wanted me out of town. So we made a deal. The police lawyer was there, and we held the trials. And it was so late in the evening now that and this is a Friday. Yes, a Friday, which meant if I didn't have the money in by Friday, my bank's closed in Chicago. So I called my office and talked to my attorney, and I said, look, I'm going to need about $50,000 down here. I said, transfer it into the bank. So they called me back, and they said, the bank president in Greenwood said he's not going to handle anything with your name on it. So I said, well, we can get him better than that. We'll do it with Western Union. Western Union has an account there. And so we have him. So we call Western Union. Western Union got in touch with him. Rather than do this in Greenwood, the bank stayed open until 6 o'clock. They closed early that day, so they wouldn't have to honor anything that would come into Western Union. So now the only thing we have left is property bonds. So we have 20 persons in jail, and we had to go out and get a property bond. So we had all the property bonds legit, but 8. So I just found 8 guys in the street. I said, where you live? And they told me. I said, what's your phone number? And I forgot a phone. I said, well, this is your number. And what's your address? And they signed it here. And it signed. So we had 8 bad problems. So about 7 o'clock that night, I told the attorney, I said, call Commissioner Hammond and tell him that Dick Gregory's ready to leave town, and the Negroes will be glad when he get out of town. But he claimed he's not going to leave town until he gets his writer out of jail. And I said, can you get him out of here tonight? So Hammond says, wait, I'll call you back. So the judge called. Now the judge is at home. And he says, you sure he'll leave if we give him that ride? I said, yep. I said, well, meet me at the court building. Now it's about 8:30 at the court building. So I tell him, I said, now when you go in, tell him that I just can't get my writer out of jail and leave because people say I came in this area, stirred up a problem, mm-hmm. and left. So tell him to give us all of them. So he went in. The judge wouldn't hear this. So I said, we got 8 bad property bonds. Get 8. So he walks in, and the judge gives him 8. And we left town. And the rest of them got out the next morning, which was Saturday. But it just turned into a game of wits. This is why I could understand King's move with the kids. After they beat you down and clobber you with everything, you reach back because there's a vicious war going on. You have to reach back and fight them any way you can. And the first let-up you have, they will print in the paper, the movement, the Negroes are not with this. You know, this is the way the story hits. And King was up against something else because in a town like Birmingham, where the population is 250,000 Negroes. Well, when you stop and think that all you can get is 2,000, it would seem like the Negro community was not behind it. But King could have got 20 to 30,000 to march down a day, but all he could get was 2,000 nonviolent ones. This is why he resorted to using the kits, because it was nonviolent. I remember my first day in town, we had to stay in the church for 2 hours while we walked outside and pleaded with the Negroes out there not to throw any bricks, not to do any shooting or anything. And we had to go and just get them in small groups and say, would you promise me that you won't? And it almost gets to a point where you can't look at it because when these people stand around and see them blast with these holes, you know, this is the problem. Yeah.
When you came back up north after the first trip, what kind of reaction did you get from people then?
It was unbelievable. The borderline guy, white and colored, that never understood what I was doing. The white that thought that I shouldn't be talking about this on stage. And the Negro, now this is not the fan. This is the guy that hears it out, read the comments in the paper. The Negro that felt, well, you're making fun of the race, mainly because these things had never been discussed openly. I say, all right, we've been accused for 100 years of carrying a switchblade. All right, now let's either admit that we got a switchblade or accuse them for owning all the missiles. Mm. You know, it's just as simple, you know. Mm. But just to mention the word switchblade, you know, this was taboo. These were the ones.
But you'd run into this before, hadn't you? I mean, didn't you run into any of this even before you went down to Mississippi?
Oh, I'm trying to explain. This is the guy I had before.
Yeah, yeah.
This was the guy that completely switched. Mm. This was the guy when I flew into Washington, D.C. Now, I travel with about 600 to 700 pounds of excess baggage. So I'm known as a good thing coming to the airport. They think I'm a good thing because the average guy gets a quarter, half a dollar. Well, I got 600 to 700 pounds of luggage. This guy don't realize how much luggage he's handling. So when I run in, I get a guy and I lay $10 on him. So I'm known all over America in the airports, you know. They run for me. I got off the airplane and walked down to Chicago, and I look at one guy, look and see if anybody else see me, and he slips away and runs. Hello, Mr. Gregory. Now, the attitude. I fly into Washington, D.C. I have one red cap waiting on me. I have another one walk up and shake my hand. And thanks a million. So I figure he gives me a note in my hand. I'm going to walk so far and throw it away. And I look, it's a $20 bill. It's the attitude of change. The white cab drivers, the white guys, the bellhops in the hotel, the guys that is there for the dollar. Yeah. I can't pay them anymore. This is the change.
Yeah.
I can't pay them. I've had a guy today that I wanted some shirts. Very hard in San Francisco to get shirts, laundry on Saturday. So he goes into place and he talks these people into doing it, you know. So if you can give him $5. No, Mr. Gregory. This is the attitude that I've changed. It's just unbelievable.
Was it more pronounced?
And let me tell you, the wild part that I still can't understand. I go to Greenwood, Mississippi, which Birmingham was heaven compared to Greenwood, Mississippi, because you never knew. You lived from second to second in Mississippi. You lived from step to step. You never knew when this one guy was going to get you from the rooftop, whereas in Birmingham, he didn't have this feeling. Now, I go to Greenwood, Mississippi, and the first time in the history of the South, a Negro was untouchable, and this made the whites look at me like I was God. Who is this guy that they will not arrest? Mm. When I would walk into the court building, the clerks, the secretaries would slip out, or if I stood outside, they would come and look through the window, not with hate, but like, there it is, right there, you know. So mentally, there was a lot accomplished in Mississippi, just going and by them making a mistake not to arrest me. Now, there was mixed emotions up north. Now I go to Birmingham, which my life was in very good shape because I was arrested an hour after I got there. I had it made in Birmingham. I could sleep. I could not sleep in Greenwood. We went to Clarksdale and they pitched a bomb in the church. And as I sit there, knowing this is it, but the bomb didn't go off. And then to see the police chief of Clarksdale walk in and tell me, he says, you know, Bobby Kennedy called me. I'm responsible for your life personally, and I promised him that you wouldn't get killed while you're here. And I said, well, I'm not worried about you, because any police chief that would hire three Negroes and take them out of jail and let them beat up three white boys, like happened here last week, three white fellas from the University of Iowa had decided to drive some food in, and this is what happened. He said, I'll take you to court and sue you for this. I said, well, your attitude's changed, because 10 years ago you'd say lynched. Now you're going to take me to court. So we had to get out of town that night. We found out there was a roadblock set up on the highway for us, so it meant we had to stay in a Negro's home. We didn't know who to trust. We got in the trunk of a car and told the guy to drive around and look, and we would stay, and he told us where we'd stay. James would sleep while I laid on the floor and watched this guy to make sure he wouldn't go to the phone and call. And I would sleep while James laid on the floor to watch this guy to make sure he wouldn't call. Because after we found out that there were Negroes there that was tipping off, solely because they're afraid, solely because they don't know what's going to happen tomorrow, and they assume that this guy knows they're involved. Now, when I go to Birmingham and I'm in jail, 3 hours after I get there, my life's in pretty good shape. I can sleep. In Greenwood, Mississippi, I couldn't sleep for the whole six days I was there. Because you just could not lay down. You know what it feels like all at once? Being in a town where if a guy walked up to me, no racial overtones involved, just says, okay, I got some bread, let's rob him. I couldn't even call the police. You know what this feels like one day when you are aware? And as I looked at my wife and said, if a group of men wanted to rape her, I couldn't call the police. This is the situation.
You're describing an occupied country in a wartime underground.
This is what it was. So now going into Birmingham and going into jail there and getting beat up, and then come back, and there's no one have asked me since Birmingham, have hinted on interviews that a lot of people say this might have been for publicity. Now, the Birmingham was the easiest one, but the Birmingham was the one that took all the doubt out. And this was the one that I decided I would stay out of because of the press and because of so many people felt it was for publicity. And I looked at about as much of it as I could. And then I decided, I called King and I said, look, I'll be in. And I had a call from the Justice Department. He was asking me, when are you going in? You know, what do you think you can do? And I said, well, I just want to be there with them. And when I go in, I do not go in to make the policies. I am not aware of what's going on. And I had they say, well, Dick Gregory, look, you're a strong fighter for the cause. We want to negotiate an agreement with you for Birmingham. I couldn't use my wildest imagination and to dream that they have segregated elevators. I could never bring myself around to believe that the seating rooms where you change to be fitted for some shoes are segregated. So these are things I'm not aware of. But it's that little guy out there in the street. This is the one I go in to be with this one here, to be the one that's exposed with the ones that's going to jail. And this is the attitude of the North now. It's like people say, well, it took a lot of guts to do what you did, you know. Well, after going into Greenwood, Mississippi, it takes guts to stay out.
You are listening to Dick Gregory in conversation with Pacifica Radio KPFA producer Ralph Gleason on May 25th, 1963. Dick Gregory passed away Saturday, August 19th, 2017, at the age of 84. If you would like to browse the entire collection of Dick Gregory recordings in the Pacifica Radio Archives, go to pacificaradioarchives.org or call us in the archives at 1-800-735-0230. And now we go to the next day, May 26th, 1963. Dick Gregory travels from Pacifica Station KPFA in Berkeley, California, to a freedom rally at the old Wrigley Field in Los Angeles, which would later become the Hollywood Park Racetrack. Hollywood came out in force to support the growing civil rights movement that would soon march on Washington, D.C. Here is a rare public address by actress Dorothy Dandridge.
We as actors and actresses should take part in the most important drama that this country has seen. And again, the name of the drama is Freedom.
Reverend Ralph Abernathy.
And nothing nor no one will be able to stop us short of first-class citizenship.
Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr.
That it is ultimately more honorable to go to jail in dignity than accept segregation and humiliation.
The rally was organized to help raise funds for the upcoming Civil Rights March on Washington that gave us Dr. King's I Have a Dream speech. To warm up the crowd, Dick Gregory spoke first and began by joking with Dr. King about their arrest in Birmingham, Alabama.
As you know, you're looking at a convict. And I understand from Dr. King that when I go back for my trial, I'll be fined $100 and they'll give me 180 days in jail. Now, I'm going to be honest with you. I don't think I could do 180 days at home. And as I have expressed to Dr. King, the reason I'm not going to do my 180 days because I can't see them giving me 180 days and only giving him five and he started it. And I think the wildest part about it all, I don't know if Dr. King realized it or not, but he could have broke it up in 3 days. Did you know that? They arrested you on Good Friday morning, and when they checked in there Easter Sunday, you should have been gone. But I tell you one thing. If any one of you decide to go down home to fight for the cause, be sure and brush up on your Uncle Tom lessons before you go. Because it might save your life. Because up north, we kind of shame old Tom. But let me tell you what Tom did for me. They got in behind me in Clarksdale, Mississippi. I jumped in the car, made it to Jackson, Mississippi, rushed in the airport, walked up to the ticket office, said, "You have reservation for Dick Gregory?" She said, "We ain't got no reservation for no Dick Gregory." I said, "Mr. Gregory, sure gonna be mad." So be sure when you go down, kind of keep Tom with you a little bit. But I say it's a new day today. This is the day today of what we call the new Negro. The Ivy League suit, the short haircut, Brill Cream, two dabs, but it's Brill Cream. You see us every day standing on the corner, Wall Street Journal under one arm, New York Times under the other, and Jet and Ebony tucked in between them. But we're making progress. 20 years ago, the light-complected Negro had it made. Today, it's the dark-complected Negro, simply because of government contracts. In order for big business to get good government contracts today, they have to hire Negro and white on an equal basis. So they go out and get the blackest cat they can find. So when that government inspector walks in that plant, he can see him 7 blocks away. Because I think the greatest thing that's happening up north today is all at once we as Negroes have almost quit being ashamed of it. And as much as we try to deny it, we have been. And if you don't believe it, ask yourself, when is the last time you run across a full-blooded Negro? Everybody want to tell you about those 37 other types of blood we got in us. And all you can see is that one. I was talking to a guy a couple of weeks ago. He said, "My great-grandmother was full-blooded Indian." I said, "What tribe?" He said, "Blackfoot." I said, "You ain't lying, man." And also, it's getting to the point that we almost have reached the stage where we're gonna quit being ashamed of the South. You can't find a Negro up north that was born and raised down south anymore. I was standing on the corner about 3 months ago. There's a guy standing next to me, got on a purple suit, green shirt, red tie, black and white imitation alligator shoes with the teeth in them. I say, "Hey, baby, where you from?" He say, "Minnesota." But one of the biggest problems we have had in America is, one, as Negroes, we haven't been able to control our own image to the extent we are ashamed. You hear people talk about a Negro crime rate, I say, "What crime rate? We're not putting 40 sticks of dynamite in mama's luggage, blowing them jet planes out the sky. And regardless of what they say about us, we haven't lynched anybody." We've had our hair talked about for so long, for 100 years now, we've been trying to straighten our wig out. And wouldn't it be a wild thing if we found out one day we had natural hair and there was something wrong with theirs? Everybody wants to lead us to believe that every Negro carries a switchblade. That's not true. I carry a switchblade, but all Negroes don't carry a switchblade. No, I'm nonviolent, Mr. King, but I wouldn't leave my switchblade at home for nothing in the world. Now, I feel I don't say nothing about their missiles. I don't want them saying nothing about my switchblade. But I don't know if you realize it or not, but the only individual in America, bar none, who's going to save this whole country is the Southern Negro. Because he has a purpose and a meaning. And when they break in the South, they're going to break clean. And when Mississippi, Georgia, Alabama, and the key Southern states put that lid on that garbage can down there, we're going to have to throw our garbage in our backyard. And it's going to stink. We have many problems in America today. I have many people ask me, Greg, why did you go? It was simple. I have three kids at home, and everything those young kids are doing down South, they're helping my three. And I don't want no one to help my kids, and I'm not going to join in. As I laid in my hotel room the night before I decided to fly into Greenwood, Mississippi, weighing out, should you go home first or into Mississippi? And you know how Mississippi won out? As I laid there and thought, if America was called into war, today I'm going. And when I can go to any of the four corners of the world, take a chance of losing my life to guarantee some foreigner a better way of life, I have to be able to go back home. I'm not going to pretend to try to explain to you what is actually going on because it's humanly impossible. You have to see it for yourself. I found out for the first time what nonviolence really meant. Anyone can lose their life fighting for their loved ones, their family, their property, but are you willing to die for a stranger? That's right.
That was Dick Gregory in Los Angeles at a freedom rally with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. just 3 months before the historic March on Washington, August 23, 1963. Professor Lamont Yakey.
When he wrote his first book, which was immensely successful, Nigger, he was making a comment, as Jimmy Baldwin would do in a more prose fashion in another way, to make us to understand that who is nigger? Who creates nigger? But Dick Gregory would embrace that term to get us to understand that, as many black people are often known within the black community, that term can mean many things, and that black people must refuse to be nigger in the most damning sense of that word by reaffirming themselves as human beings. But at the same time, understanding that nigger was a creation, not by black people, but by white people, and an offer to dominate black people.
See, I'd like to remind y'all about my book in case you haven't read it yet. That's right, the name of the book is Nigger, and this book's really come in handy to me. When I was marching down Alabama last year and the sheriff grabbed me and choked me and looked at me and said, "How you doing, nigger?" I said, "Nigger doing all right, baby." And it is. 1,400,000 copies. Yeah, the height of my ambition is to put a nigger in everybody's home. At $4.95 per nigger.
Gregory brought a black sensibility into the mix and compelled even whites to understand themselves better with regard to their confrontation or their friendship, whatever the case may be, with black people.
1967 marked the 24th anniversary of the Congress of Racial Equality, ENCORE's first national convention. Dick Gregory addressed the crowd in Oakland, California.
But it is a pleasure to be here at this convention. Hey, Dick, when I was in New York, I was standing on the corner and overheard two core members say, "Hey, man, wasn't that awful about that unspontaneous, unpremeditated ride last night?" And the other cat said, "Shh, next week." But if I can be serious for a few minutes, I'd like to talk to you. Because humor's nice, you know, a lot of people tell me about you doing a good job with humor in America, it helps solve the problems. Ah, oh, man, don't you never believe that. We never laughed Hitler out of existence. And the great researchers and the scientists will probably find a cure for cancer, and I hope this year, and it won't be through humor. And let me set the record straight, man. All humor do for me is pay my rent. Don't solve no problems. And the one crisis that we have in this country today is that we've always tried to take this great social problem with a whole lot of humor. Until we stand up and admit to ourselves that America is the number one most racist country on the face of this earth, we'll never solve the problem. And a lot of times when I go and speak and say America's a racist country, white folks get uptight. Well, any white man get uptight because I say America's a racist country is because you have so much racism that exists in you that you don't include us Negroes as being Americans. But when I say America is a racist country, that includes us and you. The sick, sad, insanity part is that 1967, we won't admit it, that it exists.
From 1967 and the Congress of Racial Equality's first national convention, we go to 1968. Dick Gregory decided to take matters into his own hands by running for the President of the United States on the Freedom and Peace Party ticket.
And like my man told you, I got my button. I'm running for President of the United States as a write-in candidate. And I know the first thing you niggas think about, you can't win. I can't win, but I bet I mess up all the history books.
Again, Lamont Yakey.
I think Dick took it seriously. I think that the officialdom didn't take it seriously. And, of course, he wouldn't get the enough support outside of the particular Freedom and Peace Party that had backed him and a few others who would vote independently in support of him. But the issues that he stood for, an immediate call to equal pay for, you know, equal work for men and women, something we're just hearing about today that I think Barack Obama signed a bill yesterday to help move us in that direction in American imperialist wars around the world. I mean, he was one of the first people to comment about the sending of troops to the Dominican Republic when Johnson did that. He spoke out early, not late, early, just like CORE and SNCC and many of his students did against the war in Vietnam. Long before Martin Luther King did, he spoke out and called for an immediate end to apartheid in South Africa, and he'd be at the forefront of those marches. They were known as the Black Liberation Day and May celebrations, where he would show up in the marches at the South African Embassy and at the U.S. State Department and so forth. It was an effort to say, look, things don't have to be the way they've always been. And even if he didn't win, he cracked the ice. Maybe Obama broke through the ice, but it had to be tested. It had to be challenged. And Dick Gregory was one of those voices that took a stand to crack the ice.
Following his unsuccessful run for the most powerful office in the world, he spoke at the University of Texas in Austin. He begins by listing the greatest breakthroughs for blacks in America.
A lot of people think we made tremendous breakthroughs in jobs and housing and education. You know, the biggest breakthrough for black folks in the history of America happened last year right here in your state of Texas. We got our first colored hurricane, Beulah. Yeah, when you can integrate that big breeze, baby. So I dozed off, and about 5 minutes later, he nudged me again. He said, "Would you explain to me what black power is?" I said, "No, I will not." He said, "Well, why?" I said, "Because for 12 months, I went out of my way to explain to white folks what black power was. Even when I couldn't get to large crowds of white folks, I'd call them up on the telephone. Hello, are you white?" No, I just think it's a waste of time to explain black power today after that tremendous heart transplant operation in South Africa where the black cat gave up his heart to the white cat, the only heart that's working right. We kind of felt the whole world after that knew what black power was. Now, that heart's working so good. You see, nothing scares black folks no more than the thought of you white folks might start assuming we gonna be your spare parts. Ever since that heart works so good, white folks kind of look at us a little bit different now. Yeah, I fell asleep in the airport about 3 weeks ago and woke up and here white cat got his ear on my chest.
In 1970, Richard Nixon had been president of the United States for over a year and had yet to fulfill his campaign pledge to end the war in Vietnam. Dick Gregory was touring on the college circuit and took the opportunity to convey his impression of the first Nixon administration.
I can't tell you how much better I feel this week than I did last week, just the fact that Dick Nixon's back in the country. I mean, I don't know about you, but I really haven't got nothing to do with Dick Nixon. But I get uptight any time the president leaves the country. I just get a sneaky suspicion he might know something. So I was worried the whole time he was gone. Not to mention that whenever Nixon leaves the country, Agnew becomes the number one boy in charge. No, that should make you sleep better at night, huh? No, when you think of Agnew being number one, see, Agnew just reminds me of the type of guy that would make a crank call to the Russians on the hotline. See, let me say it's a pleasure to be with you young folks this morning. I guess I can truthfully say that I spent about 98% of my time on college campuses today, and for a reason. And that reason is that you young folks in America is probably the most morally, honest, ethical, dedicated, committed group of young people that's ever lived in the history of this country, born none. And I hope you youngsters do not have to continue to read these old right-wing, cracker-controlled newspapers to find out who you are or what you all about. Because the average established newspaper in America today is not morally sound enough to even to discuss you young kids with yourselves. And what they call you, hippie, yippie, bearded, irresponsible, smelly kids, whatever the hell that means. And my reaction to that's always been, because you have a beard, why does that mean you have to stink? They don't say nothing about Abraham Lincoln. He didn't only have a beard, he was ugly too. And so I say to you young folks in America today, I hope you understand your importance. I hope you youngsters do not only understand, but become aware of the fact that the very faith and destiny of America depends on you. And that's a hell of a job we left for you.
Oh, you hear us sitting around talking about the problems confronting America, how difficult they are to solve. And it might scare you, it might frighten you. But please understand, all the major problems confronting America today was created by man, which means they can be solved overnight. If you use moral ethics and statesmanship ability and not sick, tired, degenerate political muscle. Everybody talks about crime. Damn right, how you gonna solve crime talking about law and order instead of talking about bread and butter?
We now fast forward from 1970 to 1974. President Richard Nixon and the Watergate break-in scandal was nightly news. In this live performance, Dick Gregory rapped on everything from slavery to J. Edgar Hoover, then head of the FBI.
Yeah, you young white kids like a breath of fresh air. Them old white folk lie. Had nerve enough to badmouth the way we talk. How about them colors can't speak no English at all? Which ain't never bothered me. I ain't got no English blood in me. And what little bit of English I do speak, the reading that sounds so bad, I learned all my English from a bad English-speaking white boy. That's right. Well, check it out for yourself. When they first brought me over here on the big boat, I wasn't speaking nothing but pure Swahili. Till that dumb white boy walked up to me one day and said, go over yonder and get that bell cop, bring it over yonder. And I thought he was just playing. Till he reached down and got that bull whoop. And I've been talking like him ever since. Yeah, them old white folk, boy, I'm telling you, the lies, it got so bad, they had nerve enough to try to blame slavery on us. Yeah, just look you right in your eye and tell you, we didn't have anything to do with it. We went over there to Africa to get some elephants, niggas just jumped on the ship. Take me, monster. Get back, niggas, elephants we want. Oh, Massa, take me. All right, boy, if you insist, get up on the boat. Anything else you want me to do for you? Yes, sir, put a chain around my leg. So I won't slip off. Sure would hate to miss that mellow ride, but whole world gone crazy. You know, there's been a lot of publicity lately about the FBI have admitted that, you know, that they kept files on black leaders, and have y'all been reading that? Now, a lot of people get upset about, you know, government agents tapping their phone and all that kind of stuff. And you see, I feel if somebody got a tap on your phone and you know they tapping it, right, then hell, you can have more fun with them than they can have with you. Like tonight, when this rally's over, I'm gonna walk down the street, go to a public phone, and call my house. When my wife pick up the phone, I'm going to read the alphabets off to her backwards. It sounds crazy to you, but the CIA be up all night trying to crack that code, huh?
Know it means, know the end of something, what is, you know.
And when I really want to have fun with them is I call the house and sometimes my wife will put my 8-month-old baby on the phone, right? And go, and the CIA has been trained to believe that there is nothing normal. Right. And so when they hear those sounds, instead of them saying, it's just a baby, the first thing they think, niggas is plotting something big tonight. Right. So they'd be up 3 days trying to crack that, right?
That does it for this edition of From the Vault. We salute Dick Gregory for a lifetime of support to all of us struggling in a world that tries to keep us divided. His comedy and wisdom and insight helped bring us all together. To find out more about the Dick Gregory recordings in our collection, go to pacificaradioarchives.org or call us in the archives at 1-800-735-0230. I'm Mark Torres. Thank you for helping keep our history alive. Thank you.
Portland.